Yes, I am Bryce Wilkinson, a senior research fellow at the New Zealand Initiative. The New Zealand Initiative is a Wellington, New Zealand-based think tank which focuses on public policy issues. Yes, certainly. Well, the difficult and interesting question for governments around the world is where to draw the balance between the severity of the measures which cut national income but hope to save lives and illness from the coronavirus. And that's quite a difficult thing to do because you're comparing apples and oranges. There's the loss of income, which can be expressed in dollar terms. National income per capita, but then there's the inconvenience and costs of sickness and death, and but economists, particularly health economists around the world and epidemiologists, have developed techniques for assessing the severity of different degrees of illness and disability, and so what I did in this report was taken some of the techniques which the epidemiologists had used in 2017 and updated them for the characteristics of the coronavirus, which weren't known in 2017, and thereby made a humble and tentative first step towards expressing those morbidity and mortality losses in dollar terms, thereby enabling a bit of a balance to be done by decision makers between those two considerations. Yes, that's right. It's highly offensive to, most people's sense of morality, and of course I feel that a bit myself, to try and express something as precious as as an individual human being with their own personality, in dollar terms. But if you stand back a little bit from that emotional thing, it's something which we all do. We all sort of trade off risk to our health from doing something a bit dangerous, like crossing the street or driving the car a bit fast or swimming in the sea when we know there's a shark there, against the benefits of that. So we all find our own balance in our private lives. And in public life, we have to too. Engineers, when designing roads or public buildings against earthquakes, they have to make a trade-off, or they have to listen to what trade-offs the people who are paying the bill is going to make, as to how much to spend on safety compared to the cost of the building. In New Zealand, for example, when designing a road for safety purposes, the value of a statistical life is put at about $4 million. So if by straightening out a bend for less than $4 million you can save one expected life, a statistical life, then the engineer should go ahead and design that corner accordingly. Yes, that's right. That was one of the figures which came out of the report. I should explain it's 6% of annual GDP, and in New Zealand, annual GDP is about 320 billion. So 6% of that is about 20 billion. So the estimate using these procedures was that The loss value of those lives and the associated sickness from people who survived but were incapacitated for a while was about just a bit under $20 billion.
That's US dollars, right?
No, New Zealand dollars, about, yeah, that's one New Zealand dollar is about 66 cents US.
Lower.
Yeah, probably more like my $10 billion in US dollars, yeah, a bit more.
Right, so 12 million maybe.
Yeah.
12 million. 3.7, so now, but the number changes, or at least the aggregate number changes, doesn't it? If you have a lower number of fatalities, which is, I guess, what you're looking at now because of the effectiveness of the lockdown in New Zealand. So you said 3.7% of GDP would be justified to spend if you just were only to be looking at the loss of 12,600 people.
Yes, that's right. And an important point is that you'd still only be justified in spending those billions of dollars if you were sure of achieving that reduction in deaths. And the difference between the 12,000 and the 33,000 reflects the epidemiologist's uncertainty as to what a pretty worst case scenario would be for New Zealand. So you can see how tentative the figures I've compiled are because of the great uncertainties by the epidemiologists as to what the deaths are actually likely to be. And then there's the uncertainty about whether measures like a lockdown will avoid all of them or just some of them, and if just some of them, how many?
The value per capita of each life changes according to those two different calculations, doesn't it?
The value of the individual life, or it's lost years due to premature death, to be more accurate, and the value of the illness to one person doesn't change between those two calculations. What's changing is the number of people involved.
Yeah, so take me through this further. You've produced that number. I mean, how on earth do you pick a number? On what basis does that become the aggregate total value of each life?
Yeah, the methodology is quite straightforward and set out in my article, and I've also published the spreadsheet, so the Excel spreadsheet, so that anybody can follow it through. So just trying to be brief, the first step is to break the age structure of the population down into about 5 yearly intervals. And the next thing to do is to get estimates of the proportion of each age group who's likely to be infected. Next step, how many of them will be sick enough to see the general practitioner? Next step, how many of those who see the general practitioner will be hospitalised? And the next step, what proportion will get into intensive care and what proportion will die? So that's the demographics and illness and morbidity, mortality side. The next thing is life expectancy tables. You work out the number of years lost due to premature death, and that's that varies a lot, obviously, with the age group you're looking at. Younger people have got a lot of years of life left ahead of them, and 80, 90-year-olds, not so much. The next step is to use internationally accepted measures of the degree of well-being loss from different levels of severity of illness. And that sort of measure is something like a quality-adjusted life year, where a level of one is a year of perfect health, and a year and zero on that measure is premature death. A mild disability is sort of 80%, say, of a good year of perfect health. more severe disability might be only 20 or 40% on that measure. So that's the critical step, having got the numbers of people into weighting the loss caused according to their age group, number of years of remaining life, and the degree of severity of the illness they get or the sickness they get before they survive. So you multiply that through, and for each age group you get that. Oh, and the other missing step is a year of perfect health has to be valued, and the conventional measure of that internationally is the country's GDP per capita, which in New Zealand is something like 50,000 New Zealand dollars, so say 35,000 US dollars per capita. So you put all that together in the spreadsheet and multiply it out, and that gives you a dollar equivalent of lost quality of life or lost life itself for each of those age groups. And you just add them all up and you get the total.
There's another calculation here, though, as well, isn't there? Because you could argue you should just be spending infinite amounts of money, or as much as New Zealand has available, to preserve the lives of its citizens.
Well, you could argue that, but that's not what the public tend to do. They do make trade-offs, and there's a strong exception to 100% tax rates. In fact, you probably wouldn't get much of GDP if you had 100% tax rate, because it wouldn't be worth people's while to work. So those trade-offs have to be made. I mean, one example I think of putting it is when resources are scarce or it's an emergency, people accept that, like in olden and perhaps more chivalrous days, if a ship was sinking, there was this cry of women and children first, which sort of makes sense in terms of the survival of the species. But that's just an example of the way people in an exigency, we have to make trade-offs.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think the other point that you make, is it not, is that there could be the same money could be spent more effectively saving lives in different ways.
Yes, that's right. And particularly immunisation programs. We've just had a measles outbreak in New Zealand, which we're very embarrassed about, because that's entirely avoidable if enough of the population are immunised. And in the Pacific Islands, there were quite a few deaths from that. So, it's very serious that money is spent well from a health and safety point of view and is not wasted.
The truth here, though, is that if you look at public policy generally, governments are pretty terrible, aren't they, at aggregating the price of a life? I mean, I think of the vast billions spent around the world on counter-terrorism, for example, which is well known to not claim that many lives. Terrorism itself is a threat. It may be very serious, brutal, and terrifying, but it probably doesn't kill that many people in developed countries, at least, and yet they are spending vast swathes, comparable with aspects of their health system on the fight to reduce that threat.
Yes, that's an interesting point. There's recent research has sort of shown that the public tend to get excited and risk-averse towards unfamiliar or novel risks, which might be quite remote, and relatively blasé about risks which they're familiar with, like the annual road toll. And so there is a tendency for them to put pressure on politicians to overreact to the novel risk. And I think and politicians are there to respond to what the public want. So I don't want to be too critical of the politicians, but I'm an analyst, an economist, and what we can hope to do is produce reports like my one, the assessments, which just help put numbers around that help people sort of decide where they want to draw the line, decide where the balance should be. But I don't for one moment presume to tell people that. I'm just here to provide some calculations which help throw some light on the trade-off.